power, fight back radio station and network. Stay tuned.
And that wraps it up for another edition of Flashpoints. Bernstein, our roving producer and producer of Biggs. For more information about the show, to listen to or download archived episodes, log on to flashpoints.net or visit our SoundCloud page at soundcloud.com/flashpoints. For questions or comments about Flashpoints, you can contact Dennis at dennisjbernstein@gmail.com. Thank you for listening.
KBOO Community Radio is supported by our members and by AMR, who would like you to know the warning signs of a heart attack. Common symptoms are pain in the chest, arms, or jaw, lightheadedness, and shortness of breath. Calling 911 as soon as you see the signs can save a life.
Welcome to Book Waves. I'm Richard Walensky.
Carlos Ruiz Zafón, who died on June 19, 2020, in Los Angeles of colorectal cancer, burst onto the literary scene in 2001 with his novel, The Shadow of the Wind. I had a chance to interview him in May 2009 for The Angels Game, second in his series of novels about the Cemetery of Forgotten Books. The next book in the series, The Prisoner of Heaven, came out in 2012, and the final book, The Labyrinth of Spirits, was published in 2018.
Shadow of the Wind and Angel's Game are two parts of a projected quartet revolving around a place called the Cemetery of Forgotten Books in Barcelona. I guess I want to start by asking you about that. Is that what came first before you began working on these novels, just the idea of this place?
Yes, actually, this is the Cemetery of Forgotten Books is pretty much the point of departure. I've noticed through the years that every time I start working on a new book and a new story, the beginning is always an image. And this is an image that intrigues me, that usually is some kind of visual metaphor for something. And I think for a few days around it, and I decide that there's a story behind it. And actually, when I remember, I got this notion of this Cemetery of Forgotten Books. And after thinking a while and seeing what it meant to me, I decided that there had to be story or stories behind it. And I started working on Shadow of the Wind.
Well, going back to these young adult novels, I understand the first one, you did not even see it as a young adult novel, but you found it marketed that way. Were the others then geared that way or just published that way?
I think what happened is I became a young adult author by accident, because it so happened that my first published novel won a big award that was given for in Spain back in 1992 for young adult fiction, and that came with a sizable amount of cash. Of course, I was starting my career as a working writer, and then you become very kind of conservative and very cautious, because of course, if you're able to make a living doing something, I became just too cautious, and I was afraid to jump out of a train that I was actually leaving somewhere. And it turned out that I had found success in a field that I never thought I would find success, because I never meant to be a young adult author. But it seems like that had just happened. So I kept writing books that I never thought that they were really young adult books. And many readers didn't think so either. Many adults would read them and say, but this stuff is kind of scary. I have to read it with the lights on. And say, well, you know, yeah, it has some characters that are young in them. That's the only thing that I can say of. And I remember that for years I thought, you know, somebody's going to knock on my door at 3 o'clock in the morning and arrest me, say, you've been faking being a young adult author. And at that time, I decided that I didn't want to keep on pretending anymore. I felt that as fine a feel as that is, it was not really my natural register, and that I had to move on. I had to expand my palette and try to write exactly the books I wanted to write. And then I wrote a fourth novel, Marina, which was some kind of hybrid. And I think that was the one that proved to me that I needed to get out of that field. After that came Shadow of the Wind, which was my very first novel in which there were no limitations that I had put on myself or that I could attribute to the fact that it was just a novel.
When you say limitations on yourself, what were you specifically thinking about?
There are more than limitations. There are some concerns of things you are not going to do in a young adult novel in terms of issues of tone, sometimes of extension, or even of complexity. There are some things that you try to keep within certain limits, and not because anybody's forcing you to, but because you think that maybe that's what you should do, which is a kind of a strange thing. It's just a prejudice you impose on yourself. And at some point, I realized that I could not do that any longer, that I didn't want to do it, and I had to just be true to myself and write what I wanted to write without thinking about this kind of limits or this kind of limitations.
Well, at that point, Carlos Ruiz Zafón, you just suddenly got this image of this place.
Well, I think this is something that came from different things. I remember at the time I was living in California, I was living in Los Angeles, and I remember driving sometimes around California, especially in Los Angeles, and finding these fantastic used bookstores that were usually in some kind of derelict part of town, undesirable part of town, which was the only place where these people could afford the rent. And some of them were just fantastic. It was this treasure copes where you could find wonderful books and for 50 cents, for 25 cents. And I remember that quite often there was nobody there. I started thinking about that stuff and thinking, I don't know, all these books here, fantastic stuff, nobody's paying any attention to. And I don't know. It was something doing the rounds in my mind. And also, I think living in Los Angeles, coming as I do, I was born and raised in Barcelona, which is kind of a very old city haunted by its own history. And then going and being in Los Angeles, in which the inverse is true. Los Angeles is a much older city than it seems, but there's something about the nature of the place. It seems to be constantly erasing history. And I remember I was very concerned about what I call the destruction of history, the destruction of memory. And I was thinking about that because I always thought, you know, we are what we remember, and the less we remember, the less we are. And I think this combination of seeing all these books lying there in these fantastic bookstores nobody was paying any attention to, and this sense that memory was being kept lost, so there was even an industrial process of destroying memory, history, the notion of where we're coming from, the things that have happened before, our identities. This somehow crystallized in this image for a place that to me was a metaphor. It was a metaphor not just for forgotten books, but for forgotten ideas, for forgotten identities, for the destruction of memory. And to me, this is what this cemetery of forgotten books meant. And I thought that there were interesting stories behind that and that I wanted to tell them and explore them.
Two threads to go here. One is Gore Vidal once said that this is the United States of amnesia, which makes me wonder, since this happened while you were living in L.A., if there's any difference between, say, the United States loss of memory and loss of memory over in Spain. And the other thread, which is entirely different, is that the first person I thought of was Borges.
Yeah, I think that this loss of memory, of identity, it happens everywhere, more or less. I think that sometimes, perhaps, for the very nature of American society, but this always looking for a word, living in the moment, or this, I think there's something about the creation of this society of people from all over, from different places, trying to find a different life, trying to find material success, trying to get, and I think this takes you, in many ways, puts your glance always in the future, which gives a very dynamic energy. When you go to Europe, for instance, of course, everything seems like it's been there forever, and a lot of people get this sense that it's very hard to change things. You come to the United States and you find that people believe that if you work hard, you can do anything. It's part of the mythology of the place. Well, part of the mythology of older places is that you cannot change anything. Why even bother? Don't even try. So it's interesting how these things are, they come from the land, from the place, and we are born into one place or the other, and we tend to absorb it because they are all around us. What happens is that when you keep changing between places and you go to places where these things are different, you start wondering about them because you don't take them for granted anymore, because you see why some people feel that way, why some other people feel in another way, and you start thinking about it and trying to figure out the reasons, and it intrigues you. And to me, this this sense of losing memory, losing history, losing your identity is something that concerns me. But I see happening everywhere. In many ways, I think it's a natural process. You know, eventually, everybody, peoples around the world tend to lose their memory or sweep things under the rug. But there's always somebody interested in you losing your memory and not really getting a really clear idea of what happened before, what went before, and where we are going. You know, the less you know about your past, the less you can control your future. And of course, there's always interests everywhere that want you to do that. So there's rarely forces trying to preserve history or memory or trying to make people aware of their identities. I think it's quite the opposite. So I think that's what it's interesting to explore these issues.
And the Borges influence must have been there.
It's always been. I think Borges was a fantastical inventor of literary artifacts. Sometimes I think of Borges more than as a storyteller, as an inventor of literary concepts. And when you go through his work, you find these flashes, these tiny little things, these pieces that are concepts. And they seem that they're lying there waiting for somebody to develop them. And a lot of the times you say, you know, behind this, there's a page and there's a notion, say, there's a great idea, but I would like this to be fleshed out and develop into a great story. And he rarely did that. He would like to invent these little pieces and create these miniatures. And of course, yes, there's a strong influence. There's a strong influence, I think, from many different traditions and things. And Borges, of course, is something that you've read, especially if you read at a young age, an impressionable young age. Makes you wonder about many things and make you question a lot of things about literature, about storytelling, because these very powerful notions, these artifacts he creates, really ignite your imagination and invite you to start thinking, what would happen if you took one of these things and tried to evolve from them and try to create something out of this notion or combine things?
The reason I mention that, of course, is because the idea is Borgesian, I guess.
Yeah.
But the writing itself, of course, is something else. People have called it Dickensian. For me, I see it as Dickensian on the one hand, but particularly in Angel's Game, I also see Chandler there. There's this feeling of that dryness of L.A. somehow impinging upon Barcelona.
Well, I think you mentioned two very interesting and some of the greatest stylists of all time, I think. When you go to Dickens, and nowadays we can go to Dickens 150 years after some of these masterworks having created, the power of the prose, the power of the images, the drive, the structure, the music of that prose is stunning and kicks the ass of 99% of the stuff that is being published nowadays. And you see, and this guy was writing at a time when you have to be aware that a lot of the science of a storytelling that has evolved through the 20th century, a lot of the things we know today about storytelling was not really that clear, but he was doing all this stuff and he was creating these fascinating images, this rich Baroque atmosphere, this kind of Gothic Victorian intensity. And I always thought that what he was doing was fascinating. It's one of my favorite writers and one of my main influence. But on the other hand, you go to Raymond Chandler. Raymond Chandler is this fantastic stylist. And the reason is that since he started being published in what was considered pulp fiction or whatever, for many years, I think he was looked upon as something minor. And I think especially because it caught up with him the second half of the 20th century with all this kind of invention of prejudices of the highbrow, the lowbrow, this kind of pretension and snobbery quite often corroding the essence of what is the literary world. And I think because of that, a lot of people have either not approached Raymond Chandler or thought, well, yeah, he was an author of crime stories. Of course he was an author of crime stories. But these crime stories are so extremely well written, are so well crafted, they did succeed and transcend as great literature. And it doesn't matter what he was writing about. He could have been writing about about supermarket bags. The guy was extremely brilliant, but what the place, the world he was living in, inspired him was these stories of corruption, of a world in which, of this mirage in which nothing was what pretended to be. And he wrote these mystery stories, and he invented a great canon in the genre that many writers still to this day are using and exploiting. And The Angel's Game, there's of course, these are books, Shadows of the Wind of The Angel's Game, these are books that are about the world of books, of literature, of style, of language, of writing, of reading. And they use many references. They may use many things. And one of the things I'm trying to do is combine many genres, combine many elements, many techniques, everything we know about storytelling, try to combine them to tell a story in a more efficient way. In the case of The Angel's Game, is a story with many elements of mystery, of thriller, and other things. But of course, incorporating all these elements that come from Raymond Chandler, from this Great Generation, James L. Cain, all these people who were fantastic writers, and we seem to forget that. We seem to think that, well, but they just were pulp fiction writers. You know, I always thought that there are just two kinds of writing. It's good writing and bad writing, and I don't care in what form it comes. Sometimes it's science fiction, sometimes it's a mainstream novel, sometimes it's a crime thriller. If it's well done, if it's well written, to me, it's good, period.
You're listening to a 2009 interview with Carlos Ruiz Zafón, author of The Cemetery of Forgotten Books Quartet, who died on June 19th at the age of 55. I'm Richard Walensky on Book Waves.
You've said that, in essence, what you're trying to do on some level is take these big 19th century novels, people like Dickens, Tolstoy, Wilkie Collins, reconstruct them using 20th century tools, the grammar of cinema, multimedia, and general fiction. What do you think you're doing in terms of the grammar of cinema or multimedia in a book like this? Because it seems to me that that's what would separate it out from, say, earlier books.
Readers of today, to me, are extremely sophisticated and not even aware of that. I think that, for instance, we go back, we think of the readers of Dickens. The readers of Dickens, or Tolstoy, Dostoevsky, or Dumas, or Balzac, had never been subjected to all these different disciplines, all these different forms of storytelling as we are subjected today. Nowadays, just because of the world we're growing up, instinctively, we are able to decode very different narrative languages that come from film, from television, from all sorts of genres of literature, from modernist fiction, from noir fiction, from mainstream fiction, that come from comic books, that come from Japanese anime, from advertising, from graphic design. All these different forms of coding, of storytelling, of languages that can be used to transmit and communicate. And what I'm interested is, I think if I'm writing for an audience, for readers who have all these kind of decoding machines installed in their brains, ready to be stimulated, are there ready to receive signals, to say, why not try to write books that work on many layers and many levels and that transmit signals in all these frequencies that can stimulate the reader's brain to provide a more intense reading experience. And then I'll use everything. And one of the things I think is very interesting is because now we are so self-aware of this storytelling conventions, of the mechanics of story, I think we can use the grammar that has evolved. I always thought the grammar of cinema evolved at first from playwriting and from 19th century novels. Eventually, it became something on its own and advanced enormously and created a very rich tradition of storytelling. So if up to well into the 20th century, novels were incorporating things from all other genres and we're learning from all other genres, why cannot we try to use a lot of the things that we know about storytelling to enrich the discourse of a novel? So in that sense, I'll use everything, and I'll use a lot of the techniques in the storytelling of using images, of creating patterns, of using movement, of using light, and trying to project all these things into the brain of the reader, you know, with great production values in Dolby Stereo's widescreen to try to, at some point, try to create books that may even disappear from your hands, that you forget that you're holding a piece of paper with ink markings and that, and that you're inside that world, because that is another layer in which the story can work. And I think it's very interesting to try to experiment with that. And the more advanced, the more I'm trying to do that, to do these books that work in many different layers to provide the most intense reading experience possible.
It sounds to me that that's a good reason why I took 8 years to work on The Angels Game. It also sounds that more than likely, and you could correct me if I'm wrong, what you did was a first draft, and then you took that first draft and almost reconstructed it from scratch, using that first draft almost as a template for what would later emerge. Is that pretty much it?
Well, the way I work more and more, what I've noticed is that I don't really work on a first draft and then I go back. What I'm doing is I rewrite everything to death. So in many ways, yeah, probably process would be analog to what you're suggesting. But the way I do it is rather than write a first draft of a story and then go back and start reconstructing, I'm constantly doing that as I write. So I never have a first or a second draft. It's constantly a work in progress at all levels. It's like a big construction site until it's done. And when it's done, it's locked. And then I work and rewrite everything to death. And then I'll rewrite it again until it does exactly what I want it to do. And when I feel that I cannot push it any further, that I don't know how to make it any better, not because it cannot be made better, because I don't know how to, and since I build a machine, nobody can either, because it's my machine, then I say, this is locked, this is closed, and nobody touches a comma, and this is what it gets published.
Do you think you stopped at the right point?
I think I did, because over the years you develop a sense if the book you've written is the book you wanted to write. It's something that is between you, between the author and the book. And I'm not trying to second-guess readers or try to please expectations of readers, say, well, what they're expecting, I don't think I should be doing that. I think I should be trying to be honest to the book I'm writing, to the story I'm writing, and service the characters, the world, to the best of my ability. And I get a sense, of course, you can't be wrong, it's a very subjective impression, but you get a point where you see, you know, I set out to do something, and this is it. This is what I wanted to do. And at some point, you know if you achieved what you wanted or not, or if something completely unknown came out and you don't know what the hell that is. I don't like to work that way. I like to get to the point where I wanted to go. And as long as it takes me, and as hard as the way may be, but once you're there, to me, the work is done. And to me, The Angel's Game is exactly the book. And every book I've published six novels so far, if they are not that, they are not published. You know, if they're not exactly the book I set out to write, I don't think it belongs in the world.
Is there a cemetery of forgotten Carlos Ruiz Zafón manuscripts?
I started publishing books in 1992. And before that, when I've been writing forever since I was a child, and I've written tons of short stories, and I wrote a couple of novels, and I wrote many things before when I was a child, when I was a teenager. And at some point, I started publishing material when I thought that this material was what I wanted it to be, that I had acquired a minimum proficiency to be able to produce material decent enough not to embarrass me and to say, yes, this is what I want to do, and I hope people enjoy it and find something of value in it, but this is what I want to do. I'm kind of stubborn, so if the work is not working, I'll just rewrite it to death until it works, and then it's in publishable form. But before that, yes, there were many things that I wrote that I needed to write them to learn, to experiment, but that they shouldn't be published.
Carlos Ruiz Zafón. Let's go back for a second to Shadow of the Wind. So you've got this idea, you write this novel. As you were working on it, was that when you decided that this would be four books of varying sorts centered around Barcelona? Or did that come afterward? Or is it still kind of nebulous that it will be four books?
This came right at the very beginning. I think when I was started working on the story, I thought that since the first notion and the first chapter of Shadow of the Wind is the introduction into this place, the Cemetery of Forgotten Books, I thought that maybe I could do these four stories that I had in mind in one book. But I soon realized that that would be impossible, because that would transform, that would produce a 4,000-page book, and that would be just ridiculous, you know, would be the size of a truck. And on top of that, it would ruin what to me was the worst thing. It would ruin the structure and the style and the personality of these four different books. Because to me, the idea and what was interesting to me was to create four stories that would be completely independent and standalone, but that could work together. It was not kind of a saga or a sequential storyline. These were four stories that were interconnected through certain elements. It was kind of a puzzle, some kind of Chinese box or labyrinth of the stories. Ideally, you could read any of these books or all of them in any order. And depending on the order you took, or if you read one or two or three or four, your experience as a reader would be different, and the puzzle would keep rearranging in front of your eyes, and you would find new connections between the characters and the places, and all of them would intersect at the Cemetery of Forgotten Books. And I thought this was what could be interesting, and each one of them would have its own personality, and they would all revolve around the world of books, of storytelling, of literature, and many things, and they would incorporate all the classic themes of literature and try to combine all the genres and all the techniques that exist and all the tricks in the book through different angles, to different perspectives. And I had a very general outline and idea of the four stories, but I thought that the right way to do, since each one of these books was going to be complex, is work in each one of them at a time. Each one of them was going to take a long time to write, and the right way to do it would be that. And of course, since this was an ongoing process, as I kept working, I kept getting new ideas and reconsidering my ideas. And that kept interesting for me and kept it alive. And I thought, as long as it's interesting to me, I'll continue trying to complete this quartet, because this is how I can make it interesting to readers. I have to believe in it first. And I decided, you know, I would like to complete this idea, this project someday, but I'll have to do it one book at a time. And maybe between some of these books, I'll write something different. I never managed to write these four books one after the other. So far, in the middle of the journey, And so far, I'm still interested in that. If at some point I was not interested in this idea, I would leave it. But it's something that I would like to do. And I think I keep thinking about it. It's a notion that came to me some time ago, but I keep rearranging it in my mind. I keep finding new possibilities. I think, you know, this could be really, really a cool thing. And I think if I manage to complete it, it can be an interesting piece of fiction.
The way I look at it is that if you read The Angels Game first, then Shadow of the Wind becomes a very clear sequel. But if you read Shadow of the Wind first, then in that sense, Daniel's parents become clearer in a different way. So you could go either way, and each way brings you into Barcelona in different ways.
Yeah, you're entering the same world, and you explore the same world through different doors of entry. So depending if you read The Angels Game first, you can experience The Shadow of the Wind differently, and the same the other way around. So, or if you just read one or the other, you get a perfectly rounded and standalone story. They have these connections, and I think that this is what makes the whole thing exciting, the fact that one book alters the other. The mere observation of one of the stories transformed the other story.
It kind of removes it in a way out of time. Barcelona itself is a character in these books. In Angel's Game, there are different areas. I don't know anything about Barcelona. It's one of those places that I really want to go to but haven't gone to. The Raval Quarter, the location of the tower, Vidal's Villa, the old quarter. Are these places real? Are they in your mind? If I were to go to Barcelona, could I do a tour of Zafón, or would I find myself lost in a mythological Barcelona of the 30s?
As a matter of fact, there are five different companies organized tours in Barcelona now around these books, and I have no connection with them whatsoever, but the fact that they do this, because you can go and find all these places. And some of them, I would say 99% of what you're reading about exists. And the other 1% could have existed or is very similar. Sometimes the very necessities of the plot make you invent something or put a building in a place where it's not. But that's very similar to something that exists in another part of town or two blocks from there. So one of the things I try to do is, even though I use Barcelona as a character, I'm very honest and true to its history, to its background, and to the physical reality of the city. What I'm doing is subjected to an extreme stylization. So in many ways, the staging, the way everything is dressed up, the way you could say it's photographed, is extremely stylized. But it's always using reality as what is in there, and it's being always very honest to the historical circumstances, to the social circumstances of the time. So I'm trying to explore that and dramatize it and give it, of course, some kind of mythological meaning and make it operatic and make it grandiose in many ways, but always departing from what is there, from the reality of the place.
Barcelona itself and Spain itself, for those of us in America, almost arrived full-blown at the time of the Spanish Civil War, meaning that we don't get much history about what happened prior to that, which is when The Angels Game occurs. So in essence, you're starting with a lost city, though maybe not from the perspective of people in Spain. I don't know.
Well, I think that for a lot of people, you know, the world, the old world of the 20s, even for readers of today or even for American readers, say, how much would we really know, or American readers do really know, but the American of the 20s, a lot of those things are kind of lost, and some people are more aware of those things, but it could be a lost world. But it's much closer than we think. I think that when we go back and explore, it's a world that is really around the corner, and it's essentially the creation of the world where we are living in today, and it's extremely relevant. I think what I try to dramatize the circumstances, the atmosphere, so in many ways, instinctively, you're already absorbing and understanding the time, not because I'm lecturing you or trying to, something historical novels tend to fail into a mode in which it seems that the author has done a lot of research and then he just bombards you with this research. And that, in dramatic terms, doesn't work. So you have to do a lot of research and then not use any of it, because you need to know about those things. So you create dramatic elements that in many ways transmit all this knowledge to the reader, but not in terms of raw data, but in terms of dramatic function. And then the reader can understand and absorb certain times at a certain place without the need to having to go through all that research. I think that's a very interesting thing to do. And this is what I'm trying to do with the world of the 1920s or the 30s.
Carlos Ruiz Zafón. Now, Shadow of the Wind takes place in the 30s and into the 40s. in Barcelona, featuring people involved with Sempere Books and Son Bookstore. Angel's Game, same bookstore, same characters in an earlier era in the 20s. Do you plan to bring Sempere and Sons back again for the other two books?
We'll see more of this place, yes. We'll see more of many of the places that we have already seen in both Shadow of the Wind and The Angel's Game, and we'll see more of also of other places that we have not discovered yet. So this world keeps growing.
You've been listening to a May 2009 interview with Carlos Ruiz Zafón, author of The Shadow of the Wind and The Angel's Game, who died on June 19, 2020, at the age of 55. I'm Richard Walensky on Book Waves. Book Waves is produced by Richard Walensky in the studios of KPFA Pacifica Radio in Berkeley, California.
You're listening to KBOO Portland.
Welcome to an encore episode of Words and Pictures, the show about the narrative arts. I'm S.W. Conser. Jan Elliott has drawn the newspaper strip Stone Soup for 20 years, chronicling the controlled chaos of a blended family in a town much like the one she calls home, Eugene, Oregon. The last daily strip is scheduled to run in October of 2020, but Jan won't be retiring completely. A weekly version of Stone Soup will continue to run in the Sunday Funnies. Jan's comics were first published in weekly alternative papers before being discovered by Universal Press Syndicate and licensed to daily newspapers across the U.S. and overseas. In honor of her long and often groundbreaking career, Bill Dodge and I will take you back now to May of 2006, when Jan joined us in the KBOO studios. While you're enjoying this vintage interview, we'd like to encourage you to take a moment, go online, and support community radio at kboo.fm. And now, Jan Elliott, recorded in Portland, May 2006.
Up next, it's Words and Pictures with guest Jan Elliott, creator of